The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. Welcome to a Thursday. My days, my whole week is all kind of inside out and backwards because I've been pulling double duty again. Since Tuesday, I've been filling in for Brad Friedman on the broadcast again. I'm a good friend. What can I tell you? They're tearing up the area around their studio. The landlords are. So it's jackhammers like all day, every day. And they can't even hear themselves think, let alone do a show. So it's me to the rescue. But let me tell you, you know, this show is live. And, I prepare for it all day. I get all my ducks in a row, as it were. And then we go live and whatever happens, happens. Yesterday, I forgot to start the YouTube stream. Sometimes we have gremlins in the studio. You know, it is what it is. But it's live and what you see is what you get. Brad's show is produced. It's on tape. He doesn't do a live show. So, you know, the little warts and things, you can't just let them go through. You got to fix them. So his show is like a puzzle because I'm putting together the pieces and I'm doing it, weaving it in and out between getting elements of this show together. So I, you know, I'm putting stuff together. It's like, wait a minute, I didn't have that guest on that show. That guest is on my show today. So pardon my, if I have a brain fart occasionally, I try not to. But it's speaking of brain farts, I got to start off with an epic one. So first of all, let me tell you, what did I just do with it? Where did he go? Is it here? No. Oh, he's there. Okay. So let me first start by telling you a little bit of news. You know how Georgia, the election officials in Georgia during the aftermath of the 2020 election, kind of got it right. You know, you have Republicans running the state, but the Secretary of State, Brad Rappensperger or something like that, did the right thing, fought back Donald Trump's encouragement to fix the election in his favor, to overturn a legitimate vote and give him the victory. I mean, you can't do it. And so, you know, he pushed back against it. Even Governor Brian Kemp, of whom I'm not a fan, pushed back to an extent. Of course, Brian Kemp was the first one then to go back and say, oh, Donald, I'm so sorry. And now apparently Brad Raffensperger, or whatever his name is doing the same thing. He's running for re-election, and, you know, he had the nerve to go against the Trump. And so I guess now he's realizing that it's probably going to cost him his job. So he's now kissing the ring, sucking the mushroom, you know. So I just had to share that with you because George is in the news. And it relates to this clip I'm going to play for you. So apparently, Brian Kemp, the governor of Georgia, was on the Fox Not News channel. And I don't know who this anchor is. It must have been overnight or on the weekend or something, because it's a black guy. And I don't think Fox has black people on during the week. I could be wrong. I don't watch, but you know. Anyway, but I saw this video. Actually, it's up on Mediaite. Otherwise, I wouldn't have seen it because, you know, it's on Fox. But this is too good not to share. And yes, I have brain farts all the time. But, you know, it's on things that maybe you don't use all that often. You know, an idea that, or a book that you read, or a song that you knew, and you just kind of don't remember the lyrics. Anyway, I think I'm saying enough, more than enough. Let's go to the videotape. Here we go. But, oh, hold on. I got it. Oh, shoot. Why are we hearing myself coming back? I got to fix that. I can't turn this pot up until, oh, I see. Okay. Maybe it's there. Okay. That was it. That was easy. All right. So Here we go now. You ready? Okay. Let's go to the videotape.
And it's unfortunate there are some that continue to scare people and not want to do that when we know how to defeat this virus now.
Yeah, at the end of the day, Governor, it comes down to choice. Adults get to make the choices. And if they want to take the vaccine, it is available to them. If they decide not to, the state should not punish them. So I thank you for your leadership on this issue, Governor.
Thanks, Lawrence. It is America, the land of the home and freedom reigns.
Now it is. We got to keep fighting.
The land of the home and the freedom reigns. Wait, let me stop this because I don't want to hear that again. But
punish them. So I thank you for your leadership on this issue. Comes down to choice.
Thanks, Lawrence. It is America, the land of the home and freedom reigns.
That would be the land of the free and the home of the brave. But, you know, who's counting? Brian Kemp, great American. Or that American. You know, while I've got the videos out, because we got a busy show for you today, let me play one more clip for you. This is President Joe Biden. And I just saw this a moment ago. And you know how a lot of these creepers on the right, these members of Congress who vote against the bills, all this stuff that the Democrats are doing to help the American people, but then they go home to their district and they brag about the thing that they voted against. So Joe Biden is doing an event. I don't know when this was or where it was. I just know it made me laugh, and laughing is good, especially now. So here's what Joe Biden said that made me laugh. Here we go.
Even my Republican friends in Congress, not a single one of them voted for the rescue plan. I'm not going to embarrass any one of them, but I have here a list.
He has a list.
Of how back in their districts they're bragging about.
Yes, they are.
The rescue plan.
Yeah.
They touted the restaurant revitalization fund.
Yeah.
They touted the fact that we're in a situation where the dealing with touted grants to community health care centers.
Mm-hmm.
Touted, I mean, some people have no shame.
Some people have no shame. And we know who those people are. They're the Republicans in Congress. By the way, they had a busy morning. If you listen to what's news today throughout the day, either by coming to NicoleSandler.com and listening there, or you subscribe to the podcast, in which case it gets delivered to you every day, or you listen to the Progressive Voices Network and you hear it playing throughout the day at the top of the hour, you'll know that the House is on recess. They've already been gone for over a week. They're out for 3 weeks now because, you know, work? Who needs to work? Anyway, but the Senate is planning on going on recess tomorrow because, you know, it's Memorial Day Monday and they have to take a week or two off, of course. So the Senate has like three issues that they were working on. One was this China issue. The bill is, let me see if I can't find the exact name of it. It was the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act, and it was set for a cloture vote today to cut off debate and move ahead. And it looked like the Republicans were going to filibuster. Chuck Schumer held the vote open for hours and somehow cut a deal with Mike Crapo of Indiana, and it passed the first procedural hurdle. So they vote cloture. They voted to open debate. So, and so this puts it on a path to passing and, more importantly, let them take up the other two issues that they needed to get on. One, of course, is the, let me find it here. The bill calling for the creation of a bipartisan January 6th commission. I don't know where they are on this, to be honest with you. I just read something that apparently Mitch McConnell, you know, the turtle looking guy, has been whipping his members to get them to vote it down. Now, Officer Sicknick's mother has been walking through the halls of the Senate office building today, along with the one cop who's been speaking out, who was beaten so badly during the insurrection, Thano or something like that, I think his name is. And they've been going personally, office to office, to implore these Republicans to do the right thing. So I don't know what's going to happen with that. And then the third issue was the infrastructure bill. And apparently the Republicans came back today with another counteroffer. This is Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, you know, Joe Manchin's counterpart, who got the Republican offer up to almost $1 trillion. So they're still, I think, you know, 700 billion apart, but they're closer than they were when the Republicans were offering 500 billion and the Democrats were at 2.4 trillion. So they say they're making progress and both sides are saying, we're not done. We're going to keep talking. And when I say both sides, even the turtle. So there you go. So go figure. I told you we have a busy show today. And, you know, usually on Thursdays, Howie Klein is here. He's not here today because, you know, last week I wasn't here last week, if that was the case. I'm all over the place. But I couldn't do it last week. And today, Howie is out because, well, you know, Howie has fought cancer for a while, and he's fine. He's I believe in remission. He's doing well, but he still is under care, under a doctor's care, and he does have what he calls hospital days. I probably once a quarter, I'm guessing. I don't remember exactly how often he goes, but today is one of his hospital days. So Howie couldn't be here today. So we have two great guests coming up. In a little while, there's a book, a new book that just came out on Tuesday. And you know how after every presidential election, some journalist writes a big book that is the book about the campaign? Well, that's kind of what this one is. It's called Battle for the Soul, Inside the Democrats' Campaigns to Defeat Trump. And it's written by Edward Isaac Devere, who is a staff writer for The Atlantic. He contracted to write this book, I think, before he even went to The Atlantic, if I recall correctly. He used to work for Politico. And the book was just released on Tuesday. This, believe it or not, was delivered an hour ago. They did send me a PDF of it, and I've been reading it in bits and pieces, you know, off my Kindle. But I'm old-fashioned. I like reading a book that's a book. So anyway, it's fascinating. Remember how, I can't even remember the name of the book, but John Heilman and the now exiled Mark Halperin did their book on the 2016 election, the 2012. I don't even remember anymore. But, you know, there's always one. This is the one. And it opens, telling you, when I first started reading it, and my blood pressure started rising because it takes you to election night 2016, sitting with Barack Obama as the returns are coming in. And he had been assured there was no chance that Hillary Clinton could lose. And then she lost. So we have Edward Isaac Devere coming up at the bottom of the hour. But so when Howie realized he couldn't be here today, he said, how'd you like one of our candidates? And I said, sure. Who you got? And he said, well, let me tell you about Shervin. Shervin, who I see is in the Zoom room, but his mic and his camera. Oh, there he goes. I just see there he goes. Because I'd rather have Shervin tell us about Shervin than me do it. So Shervin Azami is our guest. He is running for Congress from California's 30th district. That's in the Valley, in the San Fernando Valley. Yes.
That's correct.
Hi, welcome, Shervin. Nice to meet you. Welcome to the show.
Likewise. Nice to meet you, Nicole. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You know, L.A. is my old stomping grounds. I lived and worked in Los Angeles for 15 years. That's how I know Howie. I did radio when he was the president of Reprise Records. And funny, you know, we both enter the second chapter, or in my case, probably the fourth, in our lives, and we connect over progressive politics. And so, you know, but we connect on music as well. So anyway, right. What part of the San Fernando Valley encompasses the 30th district?
So the West San Fernando Valley is a pretty large district, roughly 484,000 registered voters currently. And for folks who know LA's geography, our district includes everything from West Hills and Wooden Hills on the western end to Sherman Oaks, Studio City, and even parts of Burbank on the eastern end.
Great.
And a lot of the stuff in between kind of connects from Valley Circle Boulevard over to the 405 highway with Mulholland Drive at the south being the southern border.
You're the valley.
Huge.
It is the valley. And, you know,
yeah,
there are a number.
Except the East Valley, basically.
Okay. But yeah. You are Woodland Hills and Thousand Oaks and all of that. So, wow. That's a.
Not Thousand Oaks. Thousand Oaks is outside of LAC.
Oh, that's right. That's Ventura County. Never mind. But Woodland Hills and further.
Like Woodland Hills, Encino,
down to the Reseda, 405.
Tarzana, Porter Ranch, Granada Hills.
Gotcha.
All those areas are within our district. Yeah.
I was never a Valley girl. I was a West Sider. I lived in the Hollywood
Hills.
There
are a lot of folks out there that have these preconceived notions about the Valley. And you know, I grew up here in the Valley. I'm the son of two asylum seekers who fled religious persecution in Iran at the time of the revolution. They fled to Italy. Actually, ended up being one of the only countries at the time that you could flee to without a visa. My parents grew up there for most of their youth. I was born there. And then we emigrated to the States, to the San Fernando Valley when I was an infant. And, you know, my mom worked in retail for my entire youth, working long nights, weekends, holidays, birthdays, whenever it was, trying to make ends meet. Well, my father went back to school to become a primary care physician. They left me being raised by my grandparents here in Canoga Park in Chatsworth. But the Valley's always been my home. And the Valley is also the home of the largest population of Iranians outside of Iran, lovingly referred to as Tarangelis. And, you know, one of the main reasons that I'm running, apart from, you know, my own work as legislative director for a national indigenous healthcare nonprofit in D.C., where through our advocacy, we got some very, very important bills across the finish line. Everything from bills that canceled copays and deductibles for Native American veterans, getting us one step closer to single-payer Medicare for all, to guaranteeing long-term funding for community health centers and diabetes prevention programs. I'm very proud of our work. But in my heart of hearts, I know that incrementalism and tinkering around the edges is not going to save us. We need bold structure reforms that directly uplift and empower the working class, that dismantle white supremacy and end corporate welfare. And that's what our campaign's all about. And to go against a 20 plus year corporate incumbent like Brad Sherman, who to this day still touts the fact that he was one of 19 corporate Democrats to vote against diplomacy and voting against the Iran deal.
Oh, God.
To this day, still touts it. It's disgraceful.
So again, Brad Sherman is not not stepping back. He's still running. You're primarying him.
Yep. He's the incumbent. He's been in office since I was 4 years old.
Oh, my.
And he's one of the most heavily entrenched corporate Democrats there are. And he flies under the radar intentionally. You know, he'll go out there and say, well, I co-sponsored Medicare for All. I co-sponsored the Green New Deal. As someone who's worked on the Hill, I can tell you from experience, co-sponsorship is the floor, not the ceiling.
Right.
All that goes into co-sponsoring a bill is sending a one-sentence email to the bill sponsor saying, hey, please add my boss's name to it.
Right.
You didn't have to help write it. You didn't have to offer an amendment. You didn't even have to give your opinion. But you get to add your name and go back to your community and give lip service about all the great work you're doing.
Sure.
Meanwhile, 98% of Brad's campaign contributors are corporations and lobbyists, including weapons manufacturers, private prisons, commercial banks, private equity firms, and credit card companies. The very entities actively lobbying against passage of Medicare for All that are trying to block legislating on the Green New Deal. So that's why I am sick and tired of performative gestures of candidates and politicians who just want to say they care about these issues without actually putting in the work to advocate for it. Medicare for All is a great example. We had 118 co-sponsors of Medicare for All last Congress. Did it even get a hearing? No, it did not.
Wow.
And here in our community, we have 5 unhoused neighbors die per day in our city. Over a third of our state's 3.4 million uninsured reside here in Los Angeles. We had the largest natural gas blowout in U.S. history happened in our district at Aliso Canyon back in 2015. Sure. 101,000 tons of methane blown into the air still has not been shut down, still has not begun remediation.
Wow.
And so all these issues have happened on Brad Sherman's watch, and he's failed to champion a single progressive bill to address them. He's got two bills passed in his 24 years in office, one under Trump, the other one under Bush.
Wow. Oh, that sounds a lot.
The one under Trump were sanctions on China. The one under Bush was a name change to a post office in our district.
Of course. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. See, that shows that it's time for Brad Sherman to go home.
I agree.
And there have been a number of really good progressives who finally have beaten their not progressive representatives who stayed long past their welcome. You know, the most recent, Jamal Bowman in New York, who finally unseated Elliot Engel. AOC, of course. It took over, Joe Crowley's seat. So Marie Newman, who did she took out? Dan Lipinski, who was horrible. This is, it's what we need to do. We need progressives to step up and challenge these incumbents who are frankly, too comfortable in their jobs and aren't doing the work. So, Shervin, what are you doing now? What is your background? What makes you qualified to be in Congress?
That's a great question. You know, as I was sharing, I'm the son of two asylum seekers, grew up in a working class family, raised by my grandparents, and I've always fought for social justice through the lens of public health, starting out in college, working with climate justice groups here in the Valley and across LA to address the health impacts of toxic urban runoff in our low-income communities of color, to working for a residential treatment center here in LA, where I saw firsthand how our system criminalizes mental health, criminalizes substance use, and responds to them with policing and incarceration, as opposed to providing the essential healthcare services and public health services our community members need. To my work at the national level, doing indigenous healthcare advocacy, which, like I shared earlier, one of the bills I'm most proud of in passing canceled copays and deductibles for our Native veterans, getting us one step closer to single-payer Medicare for all. And our campaign proudly accepts zero corporate PAC money.
Nice.
I've taken everything from the no fossil fuel money pledge to the no cop money pledge to the Code Pink pledge to divest from a U.S. war machine to the Sunrise Movement pledge to invest $10 trillion over the next decade into living wage union-backed jobs. And these things are essential. These things are incredibly important to our community and everyone across the entire country. And as someone who's worked in public health as a public health professional, I see the intersectionality of our issues, where when someone does not have housing, does not have good education, does not have living wage jobs, clean air and water, all these things collectively impact population health outcomes. And it's time we start investing in our communities and divesting from our military-industrial complex, from our militarized police states, and from our system of corporate welfare, and investing in our communities. And housing is an inherent human right. Healthcare is a human right. Clean air and water, strong public education, and everything in between. And as a son of asylum seekers, our immigration system is near and dear to my heart. We need to decriminalize our immigration system. I firmly believe budgets are moral documents. And when we're spending over $8 billion annually on immigration and customs enforcement on ICE, whereas asylum and immigration court services are only 5% of that amount, it demonstrates that our focus is on deportation, militarization, and incarceration, not services. And so, again, it explains why we have over a backlog of over 2 million people within our immigration court system. It's because we're not prioritizing a humane immigration system that meets our communities where they're at. And all these issues are critical to address collectively. In addition to that, we're also doing a lot of great work here in our community. We're doing mutual aid every single Sunday. I was recently endorsed by a fantastic group called the West Valley People's Alliance.
Nice.
They're the largest organization providing homeless outreach to our community. Over 20,000 meals served over the past year. And we're doing everything from providing harm reduction supplies to providing hygiene kits, food, tents, tarps, everything in between to uplift and empower our communities, because our politicians, our elected officials, are not doing that work.
Right.
They're not providing the guaranteed services we need to address the pitfalls and the injustices in our community.
You're talking a whole bunch of stuff, and I want to direct people to your website, which is Shervin, S-H-E-R-V-I-N, 4, the number 4, thevalley.com. It's easier, I guess, than trying to get people to figure out how to spell Azami. But so Shervin, number four, thevalley.com. And I'll tell you something. I can always tell a real progressive by their website because you don't shy away from the issues. So you have a whole section here, issues, and it goes housing for all, Green New Deal, public health and Medicare for all, decriminalized immigration system, criminal justice reform, education, economic justice, COVID-19, foreign policy. I get emails all the time from candidates saying, I'm running, I'd love for you, you know, I'd love to come on your show, I'd love to, and I go to their website. And they don't have an issues section. And I could go through it and I could see what they've done for a living, where they live, the awards they've gotten, but nowhere their stance on these issues that are so important. And when it's a real progressive, when you have strong opinions and beliefs, you tout them. You put them out there because you want, this is what you're for. So when you go to a website and you don't see any issues, that's a red flag. When you see a website like this, you go, okay, this is the real deal. This guy's the real deal because you're talking, you're walking the talk here. So obviously you've put in the work. You did an exploratory thing and now you're all in?
All in. We launched back in early January and it's incredible the outpouring of support we've seen. I mean, we've gotten some incredible endorsements so far, including from Howie Klein's Blue America PAC. Howie's been phenomenal since day one. So honored to be working with him. We have the endorsement of Marianne Williamson.
Yes.
We have the seal of approval of the Fuel the Burn Democratic Club here in the San Fernando Valley.
Very nice.
I mentioned the West Valley People's Alliance has endorsed us. We also have several community endorsements and from different organizations, including 90 for 90, American Youth for Climate Action. And we also have some other endorsements coming up in the future that I can't share publicly yet. We're very excited about it. And
awesome.
There's a lot of excitement around our campaign.
Great. Well, you're in nice and early. Looks like you're first.
And you know, one thing I want to bring up, Nicole, regarding your statement about our... Oh, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I got you.
Sorry about that. Just going back to your earlier comment about the issues page, you know, what's funny? A lot of people were like, do you really want to be that detailed about your policies on your website? I'm like, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, first and foremost, it's my go-to as a policy analyst by training, because I know the devil's in the details when it comes to legislation. And two, you know, it's a lot harder to hold politicians accountable when all you see when it comes to issues are platitudes and feel-good messages and just very generic, like, you know, we support housing, we support healthcare.
Right.
Okay, what exactly does that mean?
Exactly.
Do you support a public option? Do you support single-payer Medicare for all? Do you suppose addressing surprise medical billing? Like, what do you mean? You know, so specificity is important.
I agree.
And that's why our campaign took that bold step of providing very detailed plans. When we say housing for all, this is what it looks like. Everything from repealing the 20-plus year ban on new federal funds for public housing to eliminating exclusionary zoning, which is the reason why we have a lack of multifamily housing within our cities like LA and other major cities across the country.
Right.
To when it comes to single payer Medicare for all, also including a federal jobs and wages guarantee. Because as we abolish private insurance, as we move away from pharmaceutical companies, we need to provide a just transition for workers. And rebuilding our broken public health infrastructure. We saw that firsthand with COVID-19. Where our physicians in the wealthiest nation in the world, our physicians, our nurses, nurse practitioners, with trash bags as PPE.
Horrible.
It's despicable.
Just horrible.
And and all these things stem from the fact that over the past decade, and a lot of folks don't know this, in the decade preceding COVID-19, Congress nearly halved the CDC budget.
Wow.
And they didn't pass the single most important emergency preparedness bill at the federal level. It's called PAPA. The Pandemic All Hazards Preparedness Act, that bill was not reauthorized until the end of 2019. And so we weren't able to kick in the safety measures for everything from refilling our national stockpile to putting more money into emergency preparedness research, disease surveillance, and so forth. All those things came in so late. And so again, as someone who's done that work at the national level, who sees these issues through that holistic public health lens, we need to put in the work now to actually rebuilding our economy through the structural reforms we need, like Medicare for all, like housing for all, like a Green New Deal, like universal basic income, like a decriminalized immigration system, and everything in between.
It sounds great. Shervin Azami, you're in early, which is awesome because you got a lot of territory to cover, a lot of people to meet and introduce yourself to. I do have a lot of friends in L.A., again, after living there for 15 years.
Please spread the word.
I absolutely will. I will share this out and tag all my L.A. friends. And
thank you.
People will get to know you. And, of course, you know, you're in the same town as Howie, so I'm sure he will help as well.
Yep.
But, Shervin, I think we're going to be talking a number of times over the next year and a half.
I'd love that.
I would love that, too. You sound great. I'm so excited. Shervin... Number four, thevalley.com. Go check them out and spread the word. Thank you for jumping in. Thank you for running and stepping up to, help make this country great, but I don't even want to use those words. Thank you for stepping up to do the right thing and to try to turn our country around. Thank you. We'll talk again soon. Shervin
Azami. Thank you for having me on.
My pleasure.
Enjoy the rest of your day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Wow. You know, he sounds great. And, you know, I always trust Howie when he tells me, I've got another candidate for you. You know, there are other people that will say that to me, and I kind of roll my eyes like, oh, who now? When it's Howie and he's excited about a candidate, I get excited because I know it's a real progressive. I'll tell you one thing, and I got to hurry because we got to get to our next guest. Tomorrow on the program, last week, you might remember last Friday, I sat here waiting, twiddling my thumbs, waiting for this person, this guy that I know, a civil rights attorney, to come on, who believes that 2022 and 24 are going to be huge blowouts for the Democrats, that the Republicans will cease to exist. I said we could use a shot of optimism. And it was the gremlins. He swears up and down he was there. I didn't see him regardless. We have a do-over tomorrow, and I'll explain to you. But so we taped it the other day, so I know I'm not going to be stood up again. And I'll tell you the one thing that got me is I know he's very progressive, but some of the people he named as progressives that he is excited about are not all that progressive. But that's okay. They're still better than, what we have. So anyway, that's happening tomorrow on the show. All right. I mentioned the book, right? Battle for the Soul. And, The author of the book is, you've read him, I'm sure, at Politico over the years or at The Atlantic, where he works now. And this is his first book. So let's welcome our guest to the show. Uh-oh. There we go. Election. One book comes out that encompasses what happened, that makes a big splash. I remember, going back to the Clinton campaign in primary colors, and there have been others. And it seems that this year, looking back on the 2020 election and what preceded it, is the new book called Battle for the Soul, What Happened Inside Democrats' Campaigns to Defeat Trump. Edward Isaac DeVere is our guest. Thank you so much for being here today. You're a writer for The Atlantic, and this is your first book, isn't it?
It is my first book. It's a strange experience. I'm used to writing newspaper articles or magazine articles, and this is slightly longer, but I hope entertaining throughout. And it's very kind of you to put me in that company that you are at the beginning. I should say, Primary Colors, of course, was a novelization of what was happening,
that's true.
But by Joe Klein, who knew his way around things. I often felt while writing this book that this was almost like a novel unfolding, that there was so much crazy stuff that was happening, and so many interesting characters and the humanity of these folks that was coming through, and also the crisis that they were going through as Democrats and as I think all Americans were, and just figuring out what we are and what we stand for and what kind of country we're going to be. And that was really so much of it put on the line in this election. It makes me think of, there's a quote in the book from Tom Hanks, the great scholar of politics, but who did a fundraiser for Joe Biden. That was virtual, and it happened during that sort of weird virtual convention that the Democrats were having. And on the Zoom call, he says something like, when you think about all these things that are going on, All the economic crisis, public health crisis, everything, George Floyd had already happened then. That he says that all of this is happening in an election year when we actually get to make a choice. He says, you know, it makes you think like maybe there's something bigger going on. But I do think, like, whether or not you believe in his theology of it, that all of these things happened together in the election year is really insane. And it affected what the campaigns were. But, you know, George Floyd, sadly, could have been killed any other year. There have been black men killed by police before and mm-hmm. since then. The way that video was captured, the way it broke through, the pandemic obviously could have hit at any point. It happened to hit at the beginning of this and set off this everything that it did through the economy and through public health and through rethinking how things go with school and work and everything. All of that's going on. And then the crisis of democracy, you know, a lot of that is brought on by the way Donald Trump has acted sure. about the election. But, you know, that was also a long time coming in a way. And it was all put in front of voters last year in a way that they could decide what to do. They made a decision, pretty definitive one by the popular vote. But you think about it, Joe Biden got the most votes ever for mm-hmm. president of the United States. Donald Trump got the second most
That's
votes
right.
ever for president of the United States, right? And Donald Trump, in the end, is the greatest motivator to vote in human history.
On both sides of the aisle, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so what the book tries to trace, so it's like, okay, so what was happening, right? Like, I pick up this story from never before reported details of Obama and Biden watching Trump win on election.
Oh, yeah. You start there. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but yeah, I just got to say, I felt my PTSD coming back again. I start reading the book and all of a sudden I'm transported back to November 3rd, 2016. And my
November
heart 8th. Started racing.
On November 8th.
Sorry.
November
right. it's all around my birthday. But my heart started racing. I started getting that feeling in my stomach. It's like, oh my God, I remember this so clearly. And you take us back there, but to a scene that we hadn't been privy to before, which is both Barack Obama and Joe Biden witnessing the returns coming in, and neither one was particularly paying that much attention at the beginning to the presidential returns because they figured it was a done deal.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you see the process that they go through in those immediate minutes as they start to see that it's mm-hmm. real, and then in the hours and the days afterwards. And then that picks up the story of what was going on in sort of three streams of the Democratic Party. One, the elected leaders, and not really them because they were both then out of office, but people like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck mm-hmm. Schumer and what was going on with it. And more importantly, then the two other streams are these players that many of them are not household names in the Democratic Party who very quietly started to get a plan together. When nobody else, when everybody was scrambled in the Democratic Party, didn't know what to do, they start meeting. There's at the beginning of the book, there's a dinner at John Podesta's house. Podesta, who's the Clinton campaign chairman, had been a White House chief of staff for Bill Clinton. And they invites not even 10 people over for dinner, and they're sitting around the table. These people start to make a plan for what the party's going to be. But more importantly, probably, is this spontaneous reaction of activism to Trump's win among Democrats, which is more than anything brought out in the Women's March. And I covered the Women's March in D.C. I thought it would be like big, but I got there. I came out of Union Station from the metro and I couldn't walk for a while. Like, it took a while to get to where, and I never even got to the stage that was supposed to be the center of it because there were too many people. And one of the people that I talked to for the book is Cecile Richards, who was at Planned Parenthood at the time. And she was one of those people who was not at that dinner that night, but also working behind the scenes in a lot of ways for Democrats. And she said to me, look, you know, if there had been an organization that had tried to plan the Women's March, the amount of time and money it would have taken is crazy, right? Like, it never would have happened. Mm-hmm. And just happened on its own, not only in D.C., obviously, but all those Women's Marches all around the country.
Most definitely, the fact that it happened organically is pretty incredible, and seeing the outcome, not only here in the U.S., but around the world. I mean, I'm in South Florida, so we went down to Miami, but you couldn't, the thought of not going was not even a possibility. We had to show up to say, this is not okay, and we're not going to let it happen again. So,
right, and that's the day after Trump's inauguration.
The inauguration.
Like that, right.
Right. Now, Isaac, you mentioned the dinner. This was after Donald Trump's victory, that they regrouped to say, okay, we got to stop this. Cecile Richards, you said, wasn't there, but she was part of this planning group.
Because it was not like there was like a formal process, a hierarchy or whatever. There were people. She's one of the better known names, probably, of that kind of person, right? Who's not an elected leader, but very involved. Like at that dinner that night, a name who has become more familiar to people, especially with what happened with her nomination by Biden. But Neera Tanden was there. Randy Weingarten, the head of the teachers union, was there. Guy Cecil, the head of the priorities super PAC, was there. Those are the type of people who, look, maybe to your listeners, they're more known names than, but I think to most Americans, they're not really. But they are the people who were saying, okay, what do we do?
Right. But also in that group were Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, Chris Coons, Terry McAuliffe. Right. So
that's a different.
Oh, that's
dinner,
a different
that's an
dinner.
Also an important dinner. That dinner happens in the end of 2018.
I see.
So that happens after the Democrats have won the midterms.
Okay.
And that happens. It's like when I found out about this, and I'll tell you, Nicole, I actually haven't said this to people before. The way that I found out about that dinner is I happened to be meeting someone for a drink at the Four Seasons Hotel, which is at the edge of Georgetown, Washington. And as I'm waiting, the person was a little late. And as I'm waiting, I start to see people coming out of a room. Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, others like that. And I thought, what is happening? Well, insight to how the reporting can sometimes be fortuitous, right? And it was this meeting. It was the day that Pelosi had been like formally elected speaker.
Right. So it was after the midterms when the Democrats took back the House.
So she comes in and they applaud for her. But then it's like big Democratic donors had arranged it and brought in a bunch of the big Democratic leaders. Also, Terry McAuliffe was there, the former governor of Virginia, now running again. A number of other people, Pete Buttigieg was there, Eric Swalwell was there. It was sometimes, like, some of them were obvious, and some of it was like, this is the, why are we here? And the meeting's just going on and on. And basically what it was big Democratic donors who wanted the leaders to figure out how to not have a messy primary, because they were worried about it for two reasons. They didn't want to have a messy primary because they wanted to beat Trump. They also didn't want to have a messy primary because they thought that that would benefit Bernie Sanders, and they didn't want Bernie Sanders to be the nominee anyway, and they also thought he would lose to Trump. So, like, that's all going on there, and, like, it's really, you'd think that this is out of a movie, right? Like, that there actually is a room of Democrats that sat there and plotted how to do this, and at one point, someone says, what's your cursing policy on the podcast?
You say whatever the fuck you want.
Okay. All right. So what happens is that they're going around and someone says, well, maybe we can try to get it so that the candidates don't attack each other in the primary campaign. And Terry McAuliffe stands up and he goes, good fucking luck with that. You know? And of course, like, any primary campaign it would be like that. But there was such a worry about this. And, you know, they don't get a resolution that night about what to do. And most of the people in the meeting are like, why are we even here? And one of the people who was there, Guy Cecil, said to me afterwards, that was the last moment when the people who thought that they were in charge tried to be in charge. Because after that, you know, it's only a couple weeks after that that Elizabeth Warren announces her, I guess it was an exploratory committee, but obviously her campaign.
Sure.
And then very quickly, like, she announces on New Year's Eve, and by the end of January, you have a lot of other candidates, including Kamala Harris, announcing right at the end of the month.
Right. But what gets me, and I apologize, I just got the book, so I'm only a couple of chapters into it. Can't put it down.
I hope you're enjoying it.
Well, I am. When I woke up, as I do tend to do at 2:30 in the morning, instead of turning on the TV, I read until I fell back asleep. So I'm only just beginning, but I'm reading a lot. There's obviously, you've been written about a lot. In fact, I'll get to what the New York Post did today in a moment. But first, back to this meeting. I come from a progressive place. I'm a talk show host. I'm not a journalist. You're an objective journalist. So I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter. And getting this, seeing in black and white that they did it again after 2016, but they did, because we have to go later to Jim Clyburn.
Yeah.
They did it again.
Yeah. Yeah.
They worked, they colluded, I'll use that word, to make sure that Bernie Sanders didn't get the nomination. Now, I got to say, in hindsight, I'm not sure that Bernie would have won in 2020. I think he would have won in 2016. In hindsight, though, I'm not sure he would have won in 2020, but that's neither here nor there. The fact is, they got together to say, what do we do about the Bernie Sanders problem? When Bernie Sanders, to my mind, is the one who motivated thousands of people to get involved. They didn't take them from other candidates. These are people who were not involved in the electoral process at all because they thought their vote didn't count or it didn't matter or it was all fixed anyway. He got them involved. And I really think without Bernie pushing, Joe Biden perhaps wouldn't have won.
I mean, the what-ifs are hard to do here because
really
there's so many things that went into this. But like I can tell you a lot of people who worked on Bernie Sanders' campaign in 2020 think he still would have won in 2020. Uh-huh. It's hard.
He
it's
could
hard
have.
To see exactly that, right. Given the voters that were turned on for Biden, what the margins were in a couple of states that could have given Trump the Electoral College. But you are absolutely right. They were not very shy about it behind closed doors of trying to stop Bernie Sanders from being the nominee. Again, I think there are two streams of this going on. One is a distaste for Bernie Sanders' politics among a lot of Democrats. And the other is a fear that he would have lost to Trump. Now, there's also a personal element for some of them, too. People who haven't gotten over the 2016 campaign certainly hadn't then, and who just like, no Bernie Sanders. But all those things were combining, and there was absolutely an effort among Democrats to stop him from being the nominee. And look, he came very close to being the nominee.
I know.
And I think, and one of the things that I trace in the book that you'll get to is that there was a week when it was happening, when it was almost done, the Sanders campaign screwed it up, and it slipped right out of their fingers.
Was it the debate moment? Was it the debate moment when he said
the moment when he said I only need a plurality?
Yes, that you don't need a majority; you need a plurality.
Yeah, that's sort of the start of it, right? And people, his friend Larry Cohen, who runs now, that he's I think it's the chair of that group, Our Revolution.
Right. He was the Communication Workers of America.
Yes. And he worked on the Sanders campaign in 16. Mm-hmm. So he's very close to Bernie. He says that's the stupidest thing Bernie ever said.
Oh.
But it's a couple of things that happen right then that Sanders says that sort of aggravate people who are already very worried about him being the nominee. And there is this turn against him. And I'm not sure if it hadn't been Sanders as the alternative that the Biden campaign would have revived quite in the way that it had.
Huh,
but it was. I mean, that's the way life goes, the way campaigns do. And then there are like specific screw-ups that happened with the Sanders campaign. One of them was probably Sanders himself being really like brushing Jim Clyburn off completely over the years and not doing anything to build up that relationship. Another sort of coincidentally, essentially, that they wanted Jesse Jackson to endorse Sanders before South Carolina. And as I trace in the book, the problem was that Jesse Jackson didn't want to pick between Warren and Sanders. And with both of them still in the race, he says, I got to sit it out for right now.
Wow.
And I've got him on the plane with Ro Khanna, the congressman from California. They were both flying to South Carolina, and Khanna, who is one of Sanders' co-chairs in the campaign, is like, come on, can we get this to happen? It would really make a difference. And Jackson's like, no, I can't do it. And Jackson, of course, did endorse Sanders, but by the time he endorsed him, it was
too
basically
late.
Done.
Wow. That's the shame, because Bernie Sanders famously endorsed Jesse Jackson back when he ran.
Obviously, that was when he was the mayor of Burlington and for a campaign.
Still.
In a different place, but yes. Sanders feels very deeply connected to Jesse Jackson and sees his own political work as a continuation of what Jackson was doing. But Jackson is a political player himself.
Of course.
Right? Obviously, this is one of many, many factors that were going to this campaign. When you look at this, it's like, it could seem, this all just happened. No, it didn't just happen. There are a lot of things going on the surface.
A lot.
And that's what I tried to trace throughout this book.
Right. But of course, for the even more than casual observer like me, the political junkies, we saw Jim Clyburn say, hell no, Bernie Sanders is not getting this nomination. And he, for what it appeared, we know it wasn't single-handedly, but it sure looked that way, turned everything upside down on the eve of Super Tuesday, got everybody, Pete Buttigieg, to drop out on before the Super Tuesday votes. It just, it's unheard of.
And well, I mean, the chapter in the book about South Carolina and Super Tuesday is titled 72 Hours It Changed History.
Wow.
And that's because it did. It right? did. And I was in South Carolina that week reporting on it. Remember, the schedule is that the Nevada caucuses are on a Saturday. And then the following Saturday is South Carolina primary. Mm-hmm. And then 3 days later, Tuesday is Super Tuesday.
Right.
So it all happens very quickly. And that South Carolina Super Tuesday is the fastest part of it. That's the 72 hours. But you see what happens in that week of Clyburn deciding to come out. Biden had done well enough in the Nevada caucuses that he says, okay, I'm going to endorse you. He throws it in as big as he can for Biden. But even Clyburn is surprised at how big of a difference it makes for Biden, how there's this reverberating effect. For example, there was a meeting that Pete Buttigieg was supposed to have with a bunch of mayors in South Carolina. It's the mayor or whatever. It was not an endorsement event. It was just like a photo op. It would have been good for Buttigieg to have. They were willing to do it. Those mayors, after Clyburn endorsed it, you know what? We're going to cancel, right? Wow. Like it's just, it was more than the endorsement itself. It just really blew up. Simultaneously, you have some bigger pieces that were moving. I report in the book that Al Sharpton was talking to Bernie Sanders backstage, saying to him, I'm ready to endorse you. I just have to go back to my board at the National Action Network and get it to work. And then Sharpton finds out. This obviously would have been important before the South Carolina primary too, right?
Yeah.
And Sharpton finds out that Clyburn's going to endorse, and he says, "You know what? I'm not going up against Clyburn."
Oh,
and so he doesn't
God.
Do it. He never. So,
but just think, if Sharpton and Jackson had gotten on board with Bernie and went up against Clyburn, this could have changed everything, couldn't it?
It could have changed everything. I think, look, as I said, the what ifs are hard to do.
Yes.
I think what likely would have happened is that Biden still would have won South Carolina, mm-hmm. but it would not have been probably that resounding a victory. Biden gets 50% of the vote.
Yeah.
Sanders gets a lower percentage in 2020 in South Carolina than he did in 2016. That's why it's like, oh, I guess Biden's like steamrolling here. And because black voters, a huge part of the electorate in South Carolina and a huge part of the electorate for the Democratic Party, are what's powering Biden, that makes a big difference to him. And you know, there's a former state representative named Fletcher Smith that I talked to the night before the South Carolina primary at the end of a Biden event. And he said to me, you know, sometimes white people need black people to tell them what to make them see what they should do. And he's very frank about it. You know, whether or not he's right about that is a general
principle.
Yeah,
but it's not all black people. Right. But it's the whole thing is still astounding. It's not like South Carolina was going to vote for the Democrat. You know, when push comes to shove in November, when it counts, those electoral college votes from South Carolina were going to go to Donald Trump.
Right.
So the fact that this turned it around is mind blowing.
And you see in the book also that like the Biden campaign didn't realize what they had on their hands. He is 3 days later on Tuesday, on Super Tuesday in the afternoon in Los Angeles. And he's at a restaurant, a chicken and waffles restaurant.
Oh,
in, Roscoe's.
I know. I lived in LA for a long time. Yeah.
Right. And he's working the crowd. Of course, this is right pre-pandemic. So everybody's crowded. And he's there with Karen Bass, the congresswoman mm-hmm. from LA, and Eric Garcetti, the mayor. And while they're there, of course, it's Pacific time. So while they're there, Massachusetts gets called because the polls close at 7. Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren's home state, gets called right away. And they're like, what is happening? And that's when they start to get the sense that this night is going to go much better for them than they expected. But they're even as the results come in, right? Because another thing that's going on there is Mike Bloomberg's campaign. Remember that? It's all a chapter of the book for a reason, even though most people don't
would prefer
really
to forget
remember
it.
That. But it played a really important role in what happened. But Bloomberg's campaign collapses very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
There's this rush of support to Biden. There's a rush away from Sanders. As you point out, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, Beto O'Rourke all endorse Biden. The night before Super Tuesday. It's just this momentum that starts to pick up for Biden that's so fast that nobody can even make sense of it. And it's funny, it's a 500-page book. There's a lot in there, but I feel like I could have written 200 pages of it just in detailing all the different twists and turns of what happened then. It's not 200 pages there. It's maybe like 20 pages.
Right. No, but you could have. There's a movie there. There's a big story. There's a lot there. And frankly, I'm surprised, Edward Isaac DeVore, that your book, as far as I know, is really the first look at what the Democrats battled through for the 4 years to get to 2020 and to win.
Yeah.
Whether they won the soul, I don't know. Although I got to tell you that here we are. Well, if we were talking 2 weeks ago, even, you would have heard me say how I've never been happier to have been so wrong, because Joe Biden is, you know, presiding over the nation as a progressive. He's doing so much of what I never thought he would do, and surprising me. Although I got to say, in the last week or two, I've used this analogy too often, so I apologize to my listeners, but it's the new administration smell is starting to wear off, right?
Well, I would just caution you to not make any judgments, positive or negative or whatever, about what this administration is. Probably for a couple more months,
sure,
start to see what it actually really looks like. And you may love it and you may hate it. I don't know. You'll make that decision. But look, when I talked to Biden, I did an interview with him. That was his first interview as president. We were talking. He was in the Oval Office. I was over the phone because it was still heavy COVID restrictions. Two things that you might be interested in came up in that interview. First of all, at the beginning of the interview, I said to him, and I've covered Biden for years, and that means that I have a relationship with him. I know him. He knows me. And I said to him, so, you know, this book, we played around with a couple of titles, and we finally just landed, of course, this is after the riot and everything, we're going to call it Battle for the Soul. And it felt, seeing what the book looked like in the end, that was the right title for it. And, you know, Biden has this very short, sarcastic sense of humor. And so it actually, like, warmly, but it sounded, he was being sarcastic about it. He goes, yeah, you know, the difference between you and me, pal, is I actually believe it. And I said to him, you know, actually, I think you may have been onto something with the Battle for the Soul stuff. And the other thing that came up, though, is, you know, he said to me, he was reflecting on how people had counted him out at the beginning of the race, said things like, I personally wrote that people were saying he was out of sync with the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. There were much rougher ways that other people would talk about it. And he said to me, you know, I'm going to say something outrageous. Well, not that outrageous. I'm the most progressive person who's ever been president. And he said it like that on purpose. Okay. So that's a brushback, not just to Bernie Sanders,
but Barack Obama. Absolutely.
His point is, and I reflect on this in writing up the interview that I did with him, is that Joe Biden is aware that his presidency is in part a function of Donald Trump, in that he was a reaction to it and it was about getting Trump out, and that primary voters were counting on him to get them. And he's aware that his presidency is in part a function of Barack Obama and being elevated to be his vice president, connection with Black voters. But he's determined to not let that be his only place in history. He wants to be, in that interview with me, he points out the portrait of Franklin Roosevelt he has hanging over the fireplace in the Oval Office. That's who he sees now as his North Star. And that's what he's going for.
Good. I hope he keeps that, you know, burned into his mind, because that's what we need right now. The book goes into, I know from what I've read and what I've read not in the book, a lot about Obama. I've got a million questions for you. I can't wait to read the rest of it. So, Isaac, I hope that once I'm done reading that you'll come back and we can have another conversation about it. I know you have to run for an event at the Atlantic.
I'm sorry about that.
No worries.
I'd love to come back. I hope you enjoy the book. There is a lot in there about Obama. I think what you'll see about Obama is that, contrary to what was the popular conception of him over the Trump years of being detached and not caring what's going on, you'll see there's been some attention to the language that I report him using, but really what the context of that language, of how keyed in he was to what was going on, how distressed he was by it, how upset he was by it, and what it was that was really setting him off. And in a process that I think you'll see tracks with what was going on for a lot of the country and certainly for a lot of Democrats, getting more and more upset to the point that when he was campaigning for Biden into the fall, it was America is in the balance, and not the way that politicians say, like, this is the most important election ever, but for real. And that's the way Obama felt about it.
Well, it was, and there's a but there, which is the shape he left the party in. And I guess we'll end there and pick that up when we reconvene, which I can tell I'll be reading this book. So I will be back in touch. Edward Isaac Dover. How do I pronounce your last
Dover.
Name? Dover. You can read him at The Atlantic, of course, but definitely check out the new book, Battle for the Soul. What happened inside Democrats' campaigns to defeat Trump? Thank you for writing this. Thank you for joining us today. It was a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you, Nicole. I appreciate you having me.
There you go. I thought that was a great interview. I mean, if I do say so myself, he was great. The book is fascinating. I don't always read the books cover to cover. Usually, once the interview comes, I stop reading and move on to the next one. This one I'm going to read, and I will invite him back on. The book just came out on Tuesday. It's everywhere. So I hope you enjoyed that. I certainly did. Tomorrow, we'll be back tomorrow. It's a Friday. Thanks for listening, everyone. I will see you then. Have a good night. Bye.